first, did you say it was the first?
It was the first symposium on artificial insemination using the husband's sperm.
That never occurred to
It did occur to gynecologists, but was never important enough to have a meeting on that whereby doctors from all over the world appeared. And there were 500 doctors at the symposium. And one of the books that you've read is Artificial Insemination Using Husband's Sperm, is something that I was very, very interested in. And the doctors at the meeting had asked me to write the book. And it was through their suggestion that I wrote the book on artificial insemination using husband's sperm. It is very, very new, and it is very gratifying because patients are often reluctant to use artificial insemination with a donor. And as you know, a donor means that I should explain that I use a medical student who provides the sperm, and some men, and some women are reluctant. But when you say that you're going to use the husband's sperm, and there are only a few indications for that, they're much pleased because the husband feels, well, this is, at least is part of my my biological child. So. And now, I must say, since the lecture in Bordeaux, hundreds and hundreds of doctors are now performing insemination when indicated by the use of husband's sperm.
That was a giant step forward.
That was a giant step
psychological
forward.
Step forward.
And psychologically, it's very important. Now, you say about artificial insemination, do the patients accept it? Well, we're always afraid of performing artificial insemination using a donor because we don't know whether the husband will accept it after the child is born or would the wife accept it. There are many questions about that. As a result, in our office, before I left in retirement, we had a psychiatrist who would examine and talk to the couple. And it was her decision whether I should go ahead and perform artificial insemination with the donor. I also must say that there is only one sperm bank in the city of Pittsburgh, and I believe it still is the only one, and it is one that I have and have given it to one of the new doctors who is doing this type of work.
Would there be a possibility of a child, a handicapped child?
There is a possibility of any abnormality that can occur to a normal.
That's explained before.
We give each patient my book on artificial insemination and a pamphlet, which explains that we cannot provide assurance that they're going to have a normal baby. And neither can anybody who has a child. The fortunate thing of the thousands of donor artificial insemination that I've delivered, and I have a tremendous file of letters that I've received, which is private. I mean, because nobody wants to know that she had an artificially inseminated baby. But I keep it down locked and I have literally thousands of letters of appreciative people.
Amen.
And I even, as now that I'm retired, often patients will say, well, you provided me with a baby 3 years ago and you're not in practice anymore. Who shall I go to? And I get those letters every day.
But you know some of the
I know 16 of them in Pittsburgh who are now doing that. They haven't had too much training, but there are groups. For example, there may be four doctors who are obstetricians and gynecologists, and they've designated one to learn infertility by going to the various centers, which are in California, New York, and Chicago.
Obviously, the process is much more complicated than it appears to the layman.
It is very complicated, and it is even much more complicated since I started it. There are new discoveries of the use of artificial, of use of certain procedures in the world of infertility. For example, when I started infertility, there was no procedure known as laparoscopy. Now, practically every patient that is an infertility patient is subject to this procedure, which merely means that a certain tube is put into her belly button and the doctor can look at her ovaries, her uterus, and so forth under a light, and he can determine whether her pelvis has any cause for her infertility. Heretofore, we did not have that. There are new instruments every day.
So this field is just even beginning?
And it is beginning. When I even mentioned it, not too many years ago, there were only 50 members of the society. Now there are 3,000. There may be more since I'm talking to you.
You must have a wonderful, fulfilling feeling.
It is very fulfilling, and I think one of the reasons I took up obstetrics and gynecology is that, especially obstetrics and infertility, it's a pleasant profession. It's a pleasant specialty. I always attended the Brisses when I was asked, and I made a point of being there because it was usually a joyful occasion. Also, it was very easy for me to tell a patient who had a nice baby to say, I hope I see you next year or 2 years, which you can't do when someone has pneumonia or someone has a specific illness.
So your approach to medicine was more happy.
This was, and I think that's why I took it. For example, I'm very, very poor when it comes to very, very sick people when I know that there's nothing that we can do. When, even as I've already indicated, my mother-in-law died just a week ago. And we were informed by her doctors that there was no sense in giving special therapy or special operations, that nothing will do any good. Well, it was a very trying, not because she was only my mother-in-law, but it was very, very trying to see someone disintegrate, and I, as a doctor, could do nothing. Whereas in obstetrics, our mortality and our morbidity rate was very, very low. After all, a midwife can deliver a baby. We're only useful when there are complications.
But
you
always do
new
life instead of
Yes, I enjoyed that. And also, what tickled me most was when I received a letter from a patient, and not only letters. Unfortunately, I received both gifts for myself and for my children on a birthday of somebody who was an infertility problem. And I can give you many examples of very unusual things that happened with gifts, but I won't go into that because it's too complicated. I'll give you one example. For example, I did artificial insemination on a couple who came from Montreal. He was a truck driver, and he used to drive to Pittsburgh in his truck with his wife. He has since had 3 children by artificial insemination using a donor. The reason he came to Pittsburgh was, at first, that I was known as the man that does the procedure, and secondly of all, Montreal is a Catholic country, and therefore very few, if any, doctors did the procedure at that time. Well, after he had his baby, he called my office, want to know what kind of gift does Dr. Feingold need. Well, my staff learned to say Dr. Feingold doesn't need anything, and he's just as happy if you will write a letter thanking him for his role in getting the baby. But that didn't satisfy this man. And as a result, he wanted to find out my children's birthdays. And for the first 8 or 9 or 10 years of this baby's life and the others that came along, my children received war bonds on their birthdays from this man who was by no means a rich man. And it got to the point where my children would say, "Why, my birthday was day before yesterday and that man didn't send me my gift, my war bond."
Their expectations.
Well, finally I prevailed upon this man that it is not necessary for me to receive these gifts, and as a result, many, many years, I'd say 10 years of receiving gifts to both children, that he gave up, except I still do get Christmas cards around. That's one example. I have many, many more of them.
Well, we'd love to hear another story.
Well, I have another story that's, that I've is rather interesting. I lived on Marlboro Road when I first started doing infertility, and each Christmas a man would drive up from West Virginia and would put a case of whiskey on my front doorstep, ring the bell, and leave. I knew he came from West Virginia for one reason. The stamps on the bottles had West Virginia. And it was impossible for me to look through all my files and see who is from West Virginia for the simple reason that the University of West Virginia used to send me loads of patients, and I couldn't tell which one it was. The reason for that, the University of West Virginia, the obstetrician and gynecologist, did not do artificial insemination. Well, I had received these very fine bottles, a case of liquor every year, without knowing the man's name. There was no way of indicating that, except if I'd sit outside all for the first week before Christmas and look for his truck. I knew it was a truck for the simple reason that our maid once saw a truck appear and deposit the, but she did not know the license number and so forth and so on. Well, what happened was that I moved from Marlboro Road, and I told the new tenant that should he get a case of whiskey on Christmas, to please remember that it is mine and not his. And since I knew him very well, Henry Goldman, as a matter of fact, he brought the whiskey down to me every year. And that continued for many, many years. But I still do not know who gave that to me.
Yeah, it's sort of mystifying to me that this is such a vital part of gynecology that every gynecologist would not practice it now.
Well, I've already indicated it is tedious. It's long. For example, my interview with a patient who has artificial insemination in history takes about an hour. And I used to get patients from Cleveland and from all over the area, and in order to get to my office, they had to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was a long, drawn-out procedure. Financially, it was not as profitable as doing a hysterectomy. And therefore, these men who are too busy, and as you know, all doctors are much too busy, are delighted to say, well, you go to the infertility expert. You go to him. And
they can see many more patients.
They could see 20 patients to the time I see one. Actually, it is, you have to like infertility and have to enjoy it. Also, the medical schools were remiss. I happened to be fortunate to be at Chicago IMN, where Dr. Davis enjoyed doing that, and I learned a lot. But there are very few universities that have, now it's become so popular that they are now getting into infertility In fact, the other day I looked in the newspaper and under, it looked in the yellow section, and I noticed that they have a column called Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Infertility. They never had the word infertility until just last year.
Well, it's a separate discipline.
Yes.
You mean to say that medical schools are not teaching this?
They now do teaching, and they also learn it in their residency. But it's only recently that that has come. And that is actually the University of Pittsburgh, where I was assistant clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology, and I handled for a while the infertility department. At that time, we had very, very few patients. The reason we had very, very few patients, we would handle the poor, and the poor were not interested in infertility. They were not interested in having more babies. As a result, we didn't get very many patients. The Planned Parenthood Clinic had quite a successful infertility clinic because no matter how poor or rich you are, you were accepted as a patient.
When you said the Catholic Church had objections to it, which was hard for you to understand, did the church itself put any pressure on you to discontinue this?
No, they did not, but I was very fair. In fact, when a patient came, many patients were referred to me, and they would not give me the name of the doctor who referred them. I knew why. He was Catholic, and he didn't want to be connected with artificial insemination. And also, the patient who was asking for artificial insemination, the couple, would get a long lecture from me saying that I do not do artificial insemination on Catholic patients, which was true. In other words, if they claimed they were Catholic, I would say, unfortunately, your church disapproves of it, and I would rather not perform it.
Even if they prevailed on it?
They often did prevail, and the only way they were able to let me succumb is by them not telling the truth. But often I would find a name of, say, DiGostini, who would come to me and say he is a Unitarian. Mm-hmm. Well, if he went that far and that I was able to write on my record, patient and wife are Unitarians, I would perform. On one occasion, I remember distinctly that I had told the patient, in order to actually get rid of her, who was Catholic, I say, you ask your priest, if he writes me a letter saying that I can do this, why, I will gladly do it. Well, of course, about an hour later, I got a phone call from the priest who says, Dr. Feingold, these people have been in my parish for many, many years. They're a lovely couple. I cannot write that letter, but God is telling you to do it. I did it. They became pregnant, and we became friends. That is the exception. Most priests will tell you, under no circumstances.
So the decision to not do it unless they had permission from the priest was your personal decision.
It was personal, and many people would argue with me.
Yeah,
they would say, I have no right to control this. That if they want artificial insemination, I have a right, they have a right to demand this, and I should provide the service. The McGee Hospital would not allow it. When I was involved,
would not
allow me to perform artificial insemination on Catholic patients.
Regardless if you had made the decision to do it.
Well, I wouldn't make the decision to do it. I'd leave it to the social workers because they handled that. In our office, we had a professional psychiatrist. I have done this. Actually, it's surprising because if a patient came to me and asked me to give her the contraceptive pills, whether she was Catholic or not, I provided that service. But artificial insemination was too dangerous, and therefore I didn't supply it. And in my book you will read the Catholic view, and I went personally to see Monsignor Bosco, who is the local Monsignor connected with the Pittsburgh Catholic Church, and he provided me with all the reasons for not doing this. I also got violent letters from Catholic doctors and from Catholic lay people when the book came out in 1968.
People who had not been involved with
they had nothing with me. They only knew about the book. They had read the book.
You have suffered some sort of...
Well, I didn't suffer. I mean, I just accepted and knew that... By the way, you also must understand that the very religious Jews opposed artificial insemination. But it's interesting. I've been to Israel several times. In fact, I was there just a few years after they won the first war, the War of Independence. And they have an Ashkenazi rabbi, and they have the Sephardic rabbi. They also, as you know now, have a very strong, religious group in the Knesset. And I asked one of the doctors who does a lot of artificial insemination in Israel why these rabbis, who are very, very religious, permit this to happen in Israel. And he said they know all about it. They know it's being done. But deep down in their heart, they favor it. As a result, they pretend they don't know anything about it. It's very interesting to let you know that next to the United States, Israel does more artificial insemination than any other country in the world. The United States is first.
You mean an actual number?
Numbers per population, I should say. I mean, in population. After all, there are only, let's say, about 2 million Jews who will be eligible for artificial insemination in Israel, because the other population is Arab. And the Arabs oppose it, the Muslims oppose it very, very strongly. You can convince a Jew to have artificial insemination, but you can't convince a Muslim.
What is this prejudice based on? I mean, in fact, you're giving a completely religious lecture, but is it...
The only thing I could see was that actually that a very conservative Catholic Pope in 1866 presented an encyclical and said it shouldn't be done. That was enough for the Catholic Church. Well, it's against the natural law. The natural law means if you have intercourse, you should have intercourse for the purpose of natural law is to become pregnant. If you have intercourse via artificial insemination, it's not the natural way. Incidentally, they are getting a little more liberal. That depends on the local. I have to get the husband's sperm in order to see if it is bad or not, and that's provided to me by masturbation. Masturbation is not religious procedure according to both the religious Jews or the Catholics. But they claim if in the condom, in the rubber, a little pinprick is put in, then therefore the patient is excused. After all, they could get pregnant, theoretically. I can get along with a rabbi's wife much better than I can get along with a lay person in the Catholic Church. I mean, I could tell him that it's against the Catholic Church. I think you'd be interested in knowing the local Rabbi Friedhoff's attitude.
Yeah.
He's written a responsa which says that not only does the Reformed Church, Reformed Jewish temple, approve of it, but they wouldn't mind if I would use a Gentile donor. The reason being, the Jews are against consanguinity. By consanguinity, I mean brothers and sisters or relatives intermarrying. Well, if I use a Gentile donor, that possibility is very remote. So therefore, Rabbi Friedhoff, I hope he doesn't mind my saying, oh no, it's in his book, so I might as well say it. In his book says that he does not mind if I use a non-Jewish donor for a Jewish family. It's very interesting to know.
Is that true in the reverse also?
What's that?
Non-Jewish couples would not mind using a Jewish donor?
It's very interesting. All right. It's a good question. I asked a Jewish couple, would you mind if I used a Gentile donor? 90% will say, no, I'd rather you use a Jew. I ask a Gentile couple, their response is 90% of the time, I don't care, as long as he's healthy. Now, I don't know, there's something interesting in that.
Yeah.
Maybe we're a little too chauvinistic, or maybe the Gentile people who are liberal enough to come and have this done actually, I'd like to say that the people that come to me for artificial insemination are about average in intelligence. They have studied this thing. They have read about it. They know what is going on. They don't come in just to have an injection of hay fever and so forth. They've studied this. Many of them are doctors' wives and doctors. Many of them are professors and teachers. A man who hasn't studied this thing, who doesn't know anything about it, that's tantamount to adultery to him. And therefore, you won't get those people coming into your office. So already they're eliminated.
Right. They come with a mindset that's
easier
for you to
deal with. And it's very interesting that the more intelligent the person, the more willing he is to have artificial, if it's required.
Have you run into any legal entanglements?
Well, my son, as I've already told you, is a lawyer. He's with the second largest law firm in town. He's a senior partner of Kirkpatrick, Pomeroy, Lockhart & Johnson. I've asked him many times, and he thinks that I'm doing the most dangerous thing in the world, because there are many ways, and as you know how popular malpractice is now, if something went wrong with a child, they'd blame it not on the biological mother, they'd blame it on the donor. They would also have any minor abnormality, it would be easy to blame the doctor because he selected the donor. By the way, the patient never knows who the donors are, obviously, because the donor doesn't know who the patient is. He would follow the people around and want to know what his son looked like. And he thinks it's a very foolish thing for me to do. In fact, that is one of the reasons I probably gave up doing this procedure.
Wait, doctor, I think this is fascinating, and I don't want to miss because we're in the county, but we're coming to the end of this side. So
okay. Do you want to hear any more?
Sure.
Well, that's up to Barbara. Do you want to continue?
What's your time? Then your son would have preferred that you not
do it.
Endeavor.
Yeah.
Has he always felt this way?
He always felt that
way. But you persevered in it.
I persevered. He wasn't violent about it. I mean, he said foolish things. He, being a lawyer, looks at all the possibilities
that could happen.
That could happen.
But
none of them have. And I may have several thousand. I don't know. I have never checked on it. Several thousand artificial insemination. By the way, the use of the husband's sperm, there's no problem.
There's no
release.
You do not have to sign a release with
the donor? With the donor, they do. But the release means nothing, legally. In other words, they go to court, they throw that away.
Do you keep records of who were the donors?
I keep a record for 1 year. I'll tell you why. I want to wait to see what the baby's like. If the baby's fine, can I continue now?
Yeah.
If the baby is fine, I throw the record away. I don't want to ever be able to be put on a stand and say, now who is the father of this child? I would do the donor a disservice, because I promise that no one will ever know. And I would do the baby a disservice, because the baby would be growing up to know who his real father is. It's different in adoption.
Okay, do couples who have artificial insemination tell a child?
No, we instruct them not to tell the child. And many of them say that we don't even remember it's artificial insemination. We've adopted a child, and later we decided we'd rather have artificial insemination. We have to think, which is the adopted one and which is the artificial? We don't even think about it. All of them tell me that. As a matter of fact, one of the things I like to say, you know the child that you helped us with? He's great. He's musically inclined. He's going to go to Juilliard. The reason I mentioned Juilliard, I heard this the other day from a patient. He was invited to go to Juilliard. He said, my other son has no interest in music. Well, apparently the father, the donor, may have had an interest. And they're very, very proud.
Music
it may be. Apparently, it may be.
Okay.